Okay, welcome everybody to day two of this hearing. Before we begin, we have a slight shuffling up here. Officially, as a New Englander, I'm horrified, but Dave Rust is late because of the weather. Washington, as you know, shuts down for about 2 days for every inch of snow that we have. And David, in his defense, is coming in from Damascus, Maryland, which is right up quite a distance from here. So he will be here. He's on his way. He's upset that he's not here already, but he should be coming in shortly. We did know that Dr. Stephen Groft, who sat in yesterday and contributed so much, had a presentation this morning, and they did move him from third to first, I believe, on the panel, so he could get here more quickly. But we have David Eckstein from NIH sitting in his place, so I think we'll be extremely well served. I recognize a lot of the people in the audience here from day two, so I won't go through our purpose, and I think we want to get to the panelists as quickly as possible and give them as much time to make their presentations and have an exchange with the panel. But I think for any of you who were not here yesterday, our purpose here is to try to change the way in which the agency processes medical information so that we can decide disability cases more quickly and more accurately, and ultimately that means more compassionately. We've got several themes. We're looking for diseases and conditions that we ought to be able to fast track. We have new computer model techniques that can pull electronically filed applications out of the system extremely efficiently, but using certain key terms. We're in the process of taking the first of what should be a two-track system national now. It's worked very well in New England. It's rolling out through the rest of the country. We're looking to create a second track that should be even faster and easier for diseases where, by nature of the disease or condition, we're simply going to presume disability. We've also are looking to use biomarkers, imaging data, and other new scientific developments in ways that we usually haven't used them in the past to try to draw clear lines in large diseases and conditions, to try to find subpopulations where we can say with a high degree of certainty that the subpopulations meet our statutory standard for disability. And as an example of this that we've done recently, we've just updated our digestive regulations for the first time in a very long time. And we collapsed most forms of severe liver disease into one category and said that if we use a common diagnostic scale that has three components called the MELD score, if you have a score of 22 or more, we're simply going to presume disability. We're looking at doing more of that. We're also, we've had great success partnering so far with NIH, and we're discussing trying to run some clinical trials to try to tie biomarkers to functionality. So we're looking at questions whether we can use MRI scans to identify the most seriously affected multiple sclerosis patients. We're looking at questions as to whether we can use some of the nifty new techniques in cardiac imaging to measure blood flow to the heart in perhaps the same way that we have with MELD scores. Say if you're just not getting enough oxygen because you don't have enough heart function, we can't reasonably expect you to perform the functions that we use to determine whether you can engage in substantial gainful activity. So that's essentially the purpose of today's hearing. Today's is first, but it's not a one-shot deal. This is part of a planned quarterly process. They won't all be on rare diseases. The next one is on cancer. We're going to be doing psychiatric diseases, traumatic injuries, and then we'll be rolling through a regular schedule. So if you have any interest, the next three are set, and you should talk to Diane Bronstein, who's just coming in here, to get the details for the future hearings. So again, I want to thank you all for coming today. I'm sure today's panelists will be as terrific as yesterday's were. I don't know, David, Frank, do you have anything you want to say to open? Okay, I think we're good to go, and we can welcome our panelists. Our first panel today, we have three guests. We have Kathy Hunter, who's the founder and president of the International Rett Syndrome Association. We have Craig Polhamis, who's executive director of the Prader-Willi Syndrome Association. And we have Vicki Whittemore, who is vice president and scientific director of the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance. Thank you and welcome. Kathy, do you want to start for us, or do you have a set order of somebody you want to start? Okay, great.
Mr. Astru, Mr. Groth, in absence, Mr. Christodoulou, Mr. Roth.
Hold on a second, Kathy. We need to do a mic check, I think, here. I think they're off. I think we got the mics on. We discovered yesterday that you have to speak extremely close to the mics, more so than usual. So that you can not only be heard here, but theoretically we have people listening all over the country who've dialed in. So I'll ask you to speak very close to the mics.
It's a delicate balance. It's close but not loud. Okay. Good luck.
All right. we'll jump in if we have a problem.
And fellow panel members, thank you for this opportunity to participate in this Compassionate Allowances Outreach hearing on Social Security benefits for those with rare disorders. I deeply appreciate your consideration of seeking ways to better serve this population. My comments today are based on my experience as founder and president of the International Rett Syndrome Association for the last 23 years, and as the mother of a grown child, now 33 years old, with Rett Syndrome. By way of background, Rett Syndrome is a genetic and neurological disorder which affects 1 in 15,000 females. It's seen primarily in girls who develop typically for the first 12 to 18 months of life, after which a devastating regression leads to loss of speech, mobility, and hand function. Seizures, breathing problems, gastric difficulties, and loss of muscle tone and ambulation are common. Rett syndrome results in severe to profound disability by the age of 3 years. Individuals with Rett syndrome need assistance for every aspect of daily living for the remainder of their lives. They will never be self-supporting wage earners. While it is not the label but the extent of the disability which frames eligibility with Social Security, in Rett syndrome it can be assumed that any individual with a label should qualify unquestionably. However, as a rare and relatively newly discovered disorder, Rett syndrome is not widely recognized even in the medical community at large. This makes a particular problem for families advocating for their loved ones when making application for Social Security benefits. Adjudicators and even the allied medical community more often than not have never heard of Rett syndrome and may even have difficulty locating printed resources on the disorder. The typical response to saying that your child has Rett syndrome is, "What syndrome?" This prolongs the processing of claims not only in terms of establishing basic eligibility, but also in understanding the impact of Rett syndrome on the child and the family. Maintaining evidence of the diagnosis may be further delayed because the biological marker for Rett syndrome, a mutation on the MECP2 gene of the X chromosome, is now found in only 90% of known cases, leaving the remaining 10% to a clinical diagnosis. It would be very helpful to have a list of rare disorders in which the disability would be assumed. Hopefully, this would alleviate the huge backlog at Social Security by moving the simple cases much more expeditiously. Interviewers should be familiar with the list. Rett syndrome is often confused with Tourette syndrome, and they are two very different syndromes. And the inside joke on that is we usually reply to when people say, "You mean Tourette syndrome?" The response is, "No, they're two Retts and we're one." Oh. Rett syndrome is not what you get from watching too many reruns of Gone with the Wind. That's scarlet fever. The residual functional capacity questionnaire for physicians is easily and quickly completed by hand. The problem is that they are not widely used until an appeal is in process. Interviewers should be afforded some basic sensitivity training to understand the overwhelming nature of the application process for families of children with disabilities who often have kind of been through a long ordeal before they even get to the process of applying. Families on the income edge find their financial lives become an open book where every penny is counted even when the monthly income stream is unstable. Some interviewers can be very intimidating. Of
course, some can be very good as well. Sensitivity, empathy, understanding, and kindness are what are needed by parents who are already stressed. Parents should not be made to feel inadequate or greedy for seeking services that will help their children. They should be given information openly instead of reluctantly on how to determine maximum benefits or how to play the game, so to speak, without having to go underground to learn the secret formula for increasing the amount to which they are entitled. Parents should not be punished for providing financial support for their loved ones and for keeping them at home and out of institutions. Social Security programs have an immense potential to enhance the lives of individuals with rare disorders. Your attention to streamlining and improving these programs are deeply commended. Thank you.
What we're going to do with the procedure, I was out of work better yesterday, is to let each panelist speak and then hold our questions to the end, because a lot of times questions seem to have commonality, and,
sure.
And multiple panelists want to comment on that. So we're going to try to curb our enthusiasm until the end. Okay, thanks. Greg?
First, I need to say that SSI is just a vital, a tremendous, a life-saving program. It's tremendous for those populations who are able to get onto SSI. In addition to providing for Medicaid, it provides the funds that can be used to pay for group homes, which become necessary for most people with Prader-Willi syndrome as they reach their teen years and their adult years, because the behavioral problems just become too difficult for families to handle. Therefore, it's absolutely tremendous that you're undertaking this initiative. Prader-Willi is relatively rare. It's estimated to occur in one in every 12,000 to 15,000 births. With respect to SSI, we find that our individuals almost always lose at the initial determination stage. And we are unaware of any case in which, if they pursue reconsideration and appeals and hearings, we are unaware of any case in which they've lost, as I say, at the administrative judge level or earlier. It's also very easy to establish whether someone has Prader-Willi syndrome. Genetic proof is all that is required. I know you're looking for a scale in many cases, a scale of disability, and in our case that just doesn't work, because every individual that we know of is unable to work independently, usually unable to live independently as well. Prader-Willi syndrome is a complex genetic disorder affecting appetite, growth, metabolism, cognitive function, and behavior. The most notable characteristic, the one that most people know if they know anything at all about Prader-Willi syndrome, is that individuals who have this syndrome never feel full. They are always hungry. One person said, "I feel that there are 1,000 piranhas chewing at my stomach all the time." What this means is that they are therefore unable to resist food seeking. If there is food available, they will eat. They will never stop eating. If money is available that can be stolen to buy food, unfortunately that frequently happens as well. There is no drug to control this hunger. The main issues in daily life for these individuals are both food seeking and the behavioral issues. Both of these are biologically driven, and that can be proven because individuals who have had brain injuries to the hypothalamus often have what's called acquired Prader-Willi syndrome. It's not really Prader-Willi syndrome, but because the hypothalamus has been injured, the symptoms are exactly the same, thereby demonstrating that it's not a matter of lack of self-control, is biologically driven. There have been tremendous medical advances, use of a human growth hormone as well as controlling access to food has dramatically reduced the extent of life-threatening morbid obesity among the new generation of people with Prader-Willi syndrome. But unfortunately, that does not help in any way the food-seeking behavior or the behavioral issues. In fact, an individual who is not morbidly obese will have a smaller stomach, and if they binge, they are therefore more likely to have stomach ruptures, which of course can be fatal. No matter how high-functioning an individual with Prader-Willi syndrome is, these behavioral flare-ups, including rage, will persist. If they're more intelligent, they'll be better at food-seeking. they'll be more frustrated that they're unable to behave in a normal way. And they'll be, as I say, better at stealing not just food, but also money to buy food. This is not just a matter of while you're in a workplace, going to, coming back from a workplace is also a place where food seeking can occur. I suggest that if you look around your own work environments, just be look for food or for places where money could be stolen. I suspect you'll find a surprising number of them. Not only do the food seeking and the behavioral issues make it basically impossible for regular employment, but many, perhaps most, sheltered workshops are also unable to accommodate the needs of people with Prader-Willi syndrome, because they require constant supervision, constant making sure that, no food is available. One individual who's really one of our success stories just recently was found to have been stealing food from other sheltered workshop individuals. And the question was, gee, how did he possibly get unattended in order to do that? And the answer was, gee, they let him go to the bathroom 10 times a day. So hopefully we've convinced them that he doesn't really need to go to the bathroom 10 times a day, and therefore will no longer have that capability. The behavioral issues include uncontrollable rage at the smallest things. They're unable to distinguish big issues from small issues. Someone else used my broom can be the trigger for an uncontrollable outburst, and they're also very slow at calming down from those outbursts. So that is obviously not the kind of thing that that can normally be accommodated in a work setting. As I say, your own experience, Social Security Administration's own experience, demonstrates that these people are in fact disabled. Therefore, your disability determination processes, the appeals and the hearings, the work of our crisis counselors who work with these people every day, ought to encourage them to continue with their appeal processes. All of that is wasted administrative effort, since we already know the answer. If they do not give up, they are in fact going to be found eligible for SSI. So finally, I'd like to urge you not to wait. Don't let the excellent be the enemy of the good. Don't wait until you have everything in place in order to take those steps that you already can determine are appropriate to improve the determination process. In our case, that means we're suggesting that Prader-Willi syndrome be added to the list of impairments establishing disability. There's no point in going through an individual determination of something that you know already the outcome is going to be that they are disabled, and as I say, using genetic proof that they have the syndrome, this could become an easy process. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm Vicki Whittemore with the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance, and Tuberous Sclerosis Complex is a genetic disorder that affects around an estimated 50,000 individuals in the United States, and it is caused by a defect in one of two genes, the TSC1 or TSC2 gene, that have been identified. And the disease itself has really two different parts. One is caused by abnormal development of the brain that can result then in an individual having seizures, learning disabilities anywhere from mild to severe, to autism, and also a significant number of psychiatric disorders such as attention deficit, depression, anxiety disorder, which are very significant in this population. The other aspect of the disease is that these genes are known as tumor suppressor genes. In other words, when they function in a normal individual, they suppress cell growth and tumors don't form, but when there's a mutation in one of these genes, then tumors can form in multiple organ systems. The difficult aspect about this disease is that it is highly variable from one individual with the disease to another, even within the same family. So I first heard the words tuberous sclerosis when my nephew was diagnosed in 1985, and he is now 23 years old. Very severely affected and has multiple organ involvement, autism, mental retardation. He functions about at the level of a two-year-old. And then 5 years later, after he was born, my son, youngest son, was developed seizures and was diagnosed with tuberous sclerosis, as was I. And so you can see within even our family how variable the disease can be. So to address the questions that were posed to us, first, the experience of individuals with TSC, which, as I said, is a genetic disorder and affects 1 in 6,000 live births, or approximately 50,000 Americans, in filing for benefits is mixed. Some individuals are able to apply and receive approval for benefits as quickly as 3 days later, whereas others are denied and required to appeal. This is particularly true for adults with tuberous sclerosis who are applying for the first time as adults when their condition becomes more serious or so serious that they can no longer be employed and require benefits. Secondly, the experience of individuals with TSC and their families is that no one has ever heard of the disease, and it's very often confused with tuberculosis, which is an infectious disease, not a genetic disorder. Individuals who apply for benefits are advised to supply as much documentation about the disease as possible with the application that describes the various and multiple manifestations of the disease, the chronic nature of these issues, and the fact that these issues may be so serious as to be disabling in a majority of the individuals with TSC. Individuals with tuberous sclerosis are typically followed by a neurologist because of chronic seizure disorders, and this physician is most always very knowledgeable about TSC, but most primary care physicians are not so familiar with the disease. SSA adjudicators are not familiar with TS, and the individuals applying must supply documentation of the disease, extensive medical documentation regarding their disabilities that are caused by the disease. Third, the TSC may be a terminal illness for some individuals, but the TSC community does not have experience with this aspect of processing claims since it's most often considered a chronic disorder, not a terminal illness. TSC can be terminal, however, because of the multi-system nature of the disease affecting the brain, heart, eyes, kidney, lungs, liver, skin, virtually any organ of the body. The disease can be life-threatening if appropriate diagnosis and treatment of the symptoms of the disease is not received. Since there are no treatments specifically for TS, individuals with the disease are treated for each of the symptoms of the disease: seizures, autism, brain, kidney, heart, skin, liver tumors, learning disabilities ranging from mild to severe, and as I said, mental health issues, including depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. To answer the fourth question, the current system would be greatly helped by access to a list of rare disorders that describes the potential impact of the disease, the variable manifestations of the disease, and their presentation over the lifespan of individuals with the disease, and also that details the objective medical evidence needed to establish the condition. This would alleviate the need for individuals with the disease to acquire and provide so much information about the disease itself to SSA adjudicators, and would help them by specifically identifying the information needed for their claim. The problem with many rare diseases, as I've already pointed out, including TS, is that they can be highly variable from one individual to the next, even within the same family. This is often a problem for adjudicators to understand and to obtain accurate information about the variable nature of the disease. An individual with TS may be mildly affected as a child and not require benefits, but some of the manifestations of the disease become significant during adolescence and adulthood. Having information to this effect would be very helpful for adjudicators. The diagnosis of many rare disorders has evolved significantly over the last 10 to 15 years, such that now individuals who are mildly affected by the disease are being identified and diagnosed with a particular rare disease, whereas in the past, only the most severely affected and disabled individuals were diagnosed, and this is significantly the case with tuberous sclerosis. The mildly affected individuals may have significant disability from one aspect of the disease, even though they are unaffected by other aspects of tuberous sclerosis. In addition, since research is moving so rapidly for many of the rare diseases, with the identification of the gene or genes causing the disease, elucidation of the function of these genes and the development of treatments leading to clinical trials, the landscape for treatment will also be changing significantly. Providing an avenue for updating and providing new information to the SSA from the respective rare disease research and clinical communities in a clear and concise manner would be beneficial. Also, most of the rare disease nonprofit organizations, like the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance, have volunteer professional advisory boards composed of knowledgeable healthcare professionals who could serve as a resource to the SSA as needed to assist in obtaining information about a specific rare disease. And last, the Tuberous Sclerosis Alliance greatly appreciates the opportunity to participate in this hearing and applauds the SSA on this initiative to improve service for individuals with rare diseases. These individuals and their families often struggle just to get a diagnosis of their disease, and having a quick and accurate review of their SSA claims would be beneficial. Individuals with rare diseases and their families are very often juggling medical, educational, financial, and employment issues. Clearly defining the medical evidence needed, providing lists and information about rare diseases to the adjudicators, and providing a resource through the nonprofit organizations to healthcare professionals who can assist the adjudicators when needed would greatly improve the system. In addition, providing a mechanism by which new information can be provided to the SSA as new diagnostic methods are developed, new information about the disease, and new treatments come online would also significantly benefit the processing of claims. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Before I launch into a few questions, let me say a couple things. First of all, I wanted to respond to Craig's point that certainly share the sense of urgency. So for people in the audience who were not listening yesterday, our general time frame for creating we've got the QDD process, which will be the slightly slower and less automatic of the two fast tracks. That's up and running now. Last report I had, we were had 28 states up and running. That should be pretty much nationwide within a matter of a few weeks. The compassion allowance track, probably reasonable expectation would be sometime around Labor Day of next year. It might be a little bit sooner. It is important when we're doing new things to do them right. We have a little bit of a track record of the best of intentions of rushing things and then creating problems in the field. At the end of the day, we don't do anyone any favors if we don't have our systems tested properly, if we don't have the training done and that type of thing. It may be possible to give some guidance to the field before that, so that there's something transitional, perhaps in a commissioner's ruling, and we're talking about that, and it may be possible to do that relatively promptly. So we are looking at the possibility of that as well, but it shouldn't be extremely long timelines. And the other thing I just want to say is, we are focused here primarily on trying to come up with a compassion allowance list, but we realize that there are a number of very serious diseases where, because there is a moderate population, often a very small part, we probably have it on the QDD list rather than compassion allowance. And there will also be a few diseases that we're looking at in this panel where, because it is complex and because there's a spectrum, we may only be able to put a subpopulation on one of those lists, and it may be that the ultimate answer is we just have to give a lot more detail in our listings the way we do for diseases generally. And we have very few rare diseases in our listings in general. So there are basically three buckets, and although we've advertised this as a compassion allowance hearing, we're not going to be fussy about that. I think we're just trying to figure out, you know, the right thing to do for as many of the rare disease populations as possible. So that may be helpful in terms of clarifying where we are and what we're trying to do. Let me start with the disease I'm by far the most familiar with, which is Rett syndrome, because your folks
came. What a blessing to hear you say that.
When I was a biotech CEO, your association, some parents came in and spent a morning with me and my scientists, and we took a very serious look at it. And it was very frustrating because we concluded, that we could make the protein properly, and that B, we were persuaded, we were outliers on that we could administer protein to the brain. We're looking at modifying the Ollmeyer shunts that they use for oncology to administer protein in the brain. I believe the company that bought my company is still on the track to do that fairly soon. I think that the technical problem we ran up against is it turns out that, unlike most of the protein deficiencies, you just need huge quantities of the protein, and our technical people came to the conclusion that we just couldn't, through that mechanism, administer that much protein in the brain. So it was very frustrating because we got some initial threshold answers that were positive, and then we got basically to the last technical issue and just decided it was a no-go. But we did spend several weeks in analysis on that. So it's one that I'm a little bit more familiar with. And I think this is one of the, ought to be one of the easier cases. In fact, I've been using it as an example, and I know that we've got the National Association of Disability Examiners in the back of the room there. And I actually, when I was speaking to them in South Dakota 3 or 4 months ago, used this as one of the examples. I actually asked the audience how many of the examiners had actually seen a Rett syndrome case over the course of their careers, and about half of them raised their hand and said that they had seen it, but half of them had never seen a Rett syndrome case. So I guess the big question I have for you, I mean, the course of the disease is pretty clear in most of these cases, and for most of the patients, the diagnosis is pretty clear, and of course, you know, from our parochial point of view, that just makes life easier for the most part for us. So the only thing that I really see off the top of my head is a complication. As you mentioned, the 10% of the patients where there's not a genetic diagnosis. If you could talk to me a little bit more about how those patients are diagnosed, if there's any science underlying, you know, of that, and whether the course of the disease is any different for that 10% of the population.
First of all, as the mother of the first child in the United States diagnosed with Rett syndrome, there are no more wonderful words to hear than,
"I'm most familiar with Rett syndrome." That's just amazing to me, and I'm most happy in a room full of people talking about and educating them about Rett syndrome.
Well, it's a credit to your group because you came and found me, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. So it's nothing I did. It was all, you know, you were doing the right things and trying to reach out to people that might be doing research in the area. So it's really,
yes,
it's all credit to your colleagues.
Yes, thank you. Right now, it's between 90% and 95% of girls who actually get the molecular diagnosis, and the remaining 5% are probably have just a more obscure mutation. There are more than 200 different mutations on the MECP2 gene, and these are found in 8 different hotspots. Some children will actually have their own solitary mutation that is independent, and so that causes more difficulty in terms of research when they have a spontaneous mutation, that is, when you have a rare disorder and then a rare mutation within that disorder. But the treatment is no different. It's just that the MECP2 gene has also been connected to other late orders of disorders of late development, such as schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disorder. So the MECP2 mutation can result in Rett syndrome. It can also result in other disorders. So in order to get the diagnosis of Rett syndrome, you must have the mutation and you must meet the clinical criteria. However, you can meet the clinical criteria and not have the mutation because we have a 95% rate of finding mutations. And the other, subgroup of children, 5%, you know, they fulfill the diagnostic criteria, and years ago that was all we had to make the diagnosis of Rett syndrome. So it's just a matter of refining technology to be able to find the mutations in those remaining 5%.
That 5%, is the natural history of the disease pretty much the same?
Or yes, oh yes.
It's
yes.
not, and it's yes. fairly common in protein deficiencies yes. that you have at least in some cases a more moderate group where there's some residual capacity to make protein, but
we definitely find there are some mutations that are related to more severe cases. We have a genotype-phenotype database that is being able to correlate that, and so we do find that there are some mutations that present as milder cases. The complicating factor is that The severity really is determined by the exon activation rate, which is independent of what the mutation is. So there are two factors to consider. So you can have two children with the same mutation who present very differently. But, you know, in terms of qualifying for SSI, the majority of these children are nonverbal, completely nonverbal. A few of them have single words, a few phrases, but even those who do have a few words, mommy, food, you know, very basic things, you know, they're not functional with language. And about half of them are able to walk. None of them have functional use of their hands. So they're not able to work without hand-over-hand assistance. So it's really, probably should be a very clear one that someone, a clear case that someone with Rett syndrome should qualify.
Let me move on to Craig. So I'm less familiar with Prader-Willi's. If you could talk to me a little bit more, we have a very demanding statute here, the 12 months of being unable to perform work in the economy. And you mentioned people in the workplace stealing and stealing food and that type of thing. Can you talk to me a little bit more about what percentage of the population is in the workplace, what types of job functions they tend to perform, and how long they tend to last in the workforce and that type of thing?
If you're talking about regular employment, not sheltered employment, there's very, very little. You make it through school because you can get even a one-on-one aid if necessary, but that's basically what you would need in the workplace as well. So, I mean, we have people who can work for churches often as volunteer, occasionally they get paid for it. We did have someone who was stocking in Target, but lo and behold, when he was stocking cookies, it ended up he was eating the cookies. You know, if anyone leaves their locker unattended, it's going to be opened up, and they'll look for food or they'll look for money in order to buy food. We have some parents who take their kids to the workplace, and in fact this applies to school as well, take their kids to the workplace every day, pick them up, bring them back every day, but unless they stay there with them, or if someone else stay there with them, the likelihood that they'll continue in employment, I'm not aware of anyone who's lasted a full year.
Okay, so that's pretty much a blank. And there isn't a milder population that has some success in, you know, limited employment? No,
there's not. And okay. In fact, in most cases, they're also unable to, I mean, obviously you can't live independently either. You need 24-hour supervision. The group home has to lock their kitchens and lock their cabinets.
Yeah. Just one other question I wanted to ask, just because I was curious. Is this a protein deficiency, or do they know the mechanism of action for the disease?
No, it's a defect in chromosome 15. It's actually the paternal chromosome 15, which doesn't get activated. There are at least three genes that are implicated, and the main impact is on the hypothalamus. Now, I focused on food seeking and behavioral flare-ups because those are the ones that I felt were most significant to work. But in fact, there is a wide range. Apnea, apraxia, scoliosis, dental and saliva. There are almost every reaction to anesthetics. In almost every field of health, of medical, they have special challenges. I don't believe that it's anything as easy as a protein deficiency.
Okay, that's helpful, thank you. Vicki, just a couple questions for you. You may have the hardest, it sounded from your presentation that there is much more of a range of functionality. If you could give me a little bit more of a sense of, let's take the adult population first, just to try to make our exercise a little easier. Do you have any sense of what, right now, what percentage of the adult population is performing work outside of the sheltered workshop, is performing regular jobs in the national economy?
I would say about 50%. About 50% can
live and function independently. Some of those individuals, however, will develop kidney tumors down the line and become disabled, but they're able to work up until that point because they have very little brain involvement. So, but I would say probably about 50%.
So let me ask you again, for diseases and conditions like this, almost inevitably there are going to be some judgment calls and some close calls, and we can't eliminate that from the system entirely.
Sure.
But to the extent we can draw some lines, you know, to make a sum of the cases automatic, that will certainly, you know, be helpful. Is there any biomarker or any MRI test or anything that that we could look at that, you know, that would give us a sense for the people that are most severe, that, that, you know, that would give us a basis for saying, yes, this is somebody that would be unable to work?
Well, there's a genetic test, but that doesn't tell you anything. There are, the two genes are quite large, and we now have over 2,000 mutations identified in those two genes. So most families or individuals have their own private mutation.
Right.
So that doesn't help you much. And mutations in one gene versus the other also doesn't help. There's some slight indication that if you have a mutation in the TSC2 gene, you'll have a more severe form of the disease, but that does not carry weight. In terms of MRI, overall there is a correlation between brain lesions that are called tubers. They're sort of like birth marks in the brain. They're actually malformed areas of the cortex that are there at birth. And so the more of those tubers or brain lesions you have, the more likely you are to have early onset seizures and then lifelong learning disabilities, anywhere from mild to severe mental disabilities. So that is a fairly good biomarker, is, or marker would be to go by based on the brain MRI, but it's not 100%. I know a girl who's graduating from high school who, if you looked at her MRI, you would be astounded that she's even able to walk and talk. So it's pretty clear cut, but not 100%.
Let me ask a variant on the same question. So you mentioned, and I'm not sure I got it all, I jotted a short list here, but the range of other seizure, brain, kidney issues, that kind of thing, that are associated with the more severe forms of the disease. For the patients that seem to be heading, for instance, toward a terminal condition, is there any pattern in terms of they've got the underlying disease and they develop the kidney issues, or they develop something else in particular? As an example of what I'm thinking about, for a long time I worked in Fabry disease, and it's a, you know, it has a lot of horrible symptoms, but a lot of the patients live fairly long, even before there was enzyme replacement therapy. And the three main causes of death: stroke was unpredictable, heart was unpredictable, even though they would get swelling of the heart, you didn't seem to be able to correlate what seemed like it ought to correlate. You'd have very large hearts,
right,
but you couldn't predict the heart attack. But on the kidney, you could get, say, with a fair amount of precision, once they lost a certain amount of kidney function, they were heading toward dialysis and death within a fairly predictable period of time. Is there anything like that for the most severe patients that we could be looking at?
Yes. Most of them will succumb to either a brain or kidney tumor. So generally the kidneys become overwhelmed by these very large benign tumors, and then that leads then to individuals requiring dialysis and eventually end-stage renal failure. So yeah, those two things probably.
Okay, that's helpful. All right, I've been hogging your time. David, do you have questions you want to ask?
Not right now.
Not right now?
A couple questions. Yes, thank you very much. Appreciate the comments. I just want to clarify a couple points and add just some further questions on it. For the impairments that Ms. Hunter and Mr. Hymus have talked to us about, they're pretty clear, I think, in their impression that everyone who has the diagnosis is essentially disabled. Did I understand that correctly?
No, sir.
Okay.
Yes.
And certainly not the doctor. It's not the same. Mr. Mohamed did mention to us that a number of the cases actually get to the hearing level in our process, but once they get to the hearing level, they're always approved, right? I think is what
I'm unaware of any case that was not approved. That's correct.
Okay. And Ms. Hunter, with
the same, they're usually approved.
With the cases that actually get to the hearing level, it's pretty clear that in the first two situations, they're generally approved with the impairment that you're representing, what's the experience that you're aware of?
The experience is that it's, again, mixed. Many individuals will have been functioning normally, working, and then have, you know, end up with chronic kidney problems, needing dialysis, having severe disability, for example, and or severe disability from seizure disorder that they now cannot control and can't work. And those are very often denied on the at the hearing because a person has worked in the past and has been able to live independently in the past. So, you know, sometimes those are approved and sometimes not. It's very mixed.
And the commissioner's made it very clear that certainly the agency's looking at if there's some way that we can identify additional impairments that we can look at and simply improve, because we know that, in fact, the people will be found disabled at some point. But we still are going on at this point, certain cases, to the hearing level. Is there something that we should be asking about if the case reaches the hearing level, so that we can get some additional information at that level, even at this point, that we could get that information and make a decision very quickly without even having to go to a hearing? And that's really for all three of you. If you can think of any information that we could be asking for or anything we could be doing to help us establish pretty quickly, just looking at the record without having to hold the hearing.
In our context, I'm not really sure what that question means. It would seem to me that genetic proof of Prader-Willi syndrome based on your own experience would be sufficient. I don't know that there are any additional questions that you would need to ask.
Okay. And then probably the final question, but kind of a related question. Is there additional information we should be requesting, additional forms we should be asking people to fill out? Should we be doing anything else at the early stage of the process to make sure that the adjudicators are very familiar with the extent of the issue in the individual case?
Can I also make a friendly amendment to Judge Cruzado's question, make it a little bit more complicated? I assume for Rett syndrome that it's always going to be the case that it's a family member filling out the application or some other representative. If you have any sense, particularly I guess for the Prader-Willi patients, do the patients try to fill out the applications themselves, or do usually family members that do that?
It's
some
the parents, and often with the assistance of our crisis counselors. What our crisis counselors have to do generally is convince the parents not to give up just because they were turned down at one level. But no, I don't think anyone would try and fill out the form themselves.
Okay, so back to the question. Is there anything, Frank's question, is there anything else that in terms of documentation or solicitation from that we should be asking for more systematically that from your vantage point would help the process? Anything that you can say in terms of issues?
It's certainly very hard for me to do that, because it sounds like you're trying to distinguish between those people with a particular condition who are disabled and those people with the same condition who are not disabled, and that's not a distinction that seems to have any relevance in our case.
The treatment is no different. It's just that the MECP2 gene has also been connected to other late orders of disorders of late development, such as schizophrenia, autism, bipolar disorder. So the MECP2 mutation can result in Rett syndrome. It can also result in other disorders. So in order to get the diagnosis of Rett syndrome, you must have the mutation and you must meet the clinical criteria. However, you can meet the clinical criteria and not have the mutation,